Zaxby's just out-Philly the Philly again. The Zaxby's Chicken Philly is back with garlic aioli, sautéed peppers and onions, decadent melty cheese, and your choice of Zaxby's signature crispy chicken fingers or delicious grilled chicken. But it's only back for a limited time, so enjoy it while you can. No pressure. It's just the greatest sandwich of all time on a ticking clock. Order the Chicken Philly today. Who's got the sauce? Zaxby's. Zaxby's just out Philly the Philly again. The Zaxby's Chicken Philly is back with garlic aioli, sautéed peppers and onions, decadent melty cheese, and your choice of Zaxby's signature crispy chicken fingers or delicious grilled chicken. But it's only back for a limited time, so enjoy it while you can. No pressure. It's just the greatest sandwich of all time on a ticking clock. Order the Chicken Philly today. Who's got the sauce? Zaxby's.
Welcome to the Gravity Podcast, where we host conversations on developing a Christian spirituality rooted in love that fosters resilient faith in everyday life.
I mean, Ben, the only way to truly find out what Deb thinks about it is just to go ahead and get her her name tattooed on your knuckles and see what she thinks. And then you really know. Welcome to the Gravity Commons Podcast. My name is Matt, and I'm joined by Christy and Ben. Hello.
Hola.
Good day.
Good to see you.
Hello, friends.
Another day, another podcast.
Yeah.
Another week, another podcast, I guess. Mm-hmm. We release these weekly.
So one of the things we do in intros regularly when we remember is to share a recommendation or a story, maybe something we've read or a book. And I was convicted this morning that I made big promises in 2024 on my Substack and other social media that I would share like a brief review and slash summary of the books I've read. And I'm about 12 to 15 books behind.
And you now can knock one out right now. Just tell people to listen to the podcast.
And now I feel a bit, my mouth was writing checks that my body can't cash, which has never happened to me before, but it definitely it's happened.
New experience.
Yeah. Brand new experience. Mm-hmm. I finished one this morning and I was like, I'm just not going to, it's never going to happen.
Do it now.
Finished a tell book us. Or a review?
Oh,
finished
no.
Finished a book.
Yeah, I did not write a review. Okay. So I'll tell you about the book I read.
Yeah,
I just finished this morning. It's a book called Democracy Awakening, Notes on the State of America by Heather Cox Richardson, who teaches history at Boston College. Mm-hmm. And she focuses on American political and economic history. And it's really cool. It was a great book. I really liked it. It was basically about, you know, it's about some of the things we talk about on this podcast a lot, the rise of Christian nationalism and such. And her book is basically a history on how democracy and equality has always been in a struggle with authoritarian kind of limitations on who gets access and rights and freedoms, and mm-hmm. how those two like energies have fought throughout American history. And she kind of walks through history and talks about how those two, there's like a wave of like, liberative, equal rights, and then there's a wave of like backlash and restriction. Hmm. And I love history.
Yeah, you do.
I care about equality. So it was a good read. It was a quick read. She's a great writer. Her chapters are short, and yeah. I highly recommend it.
Cool.
That's cool. Yeah, I'm reminded of. I think sometimes I can remember feeling when I learned that stuff about American history, that it's like, oh, it hasn't always been, you know, land of the free, home of the brave, you know, mm-hmm. That kind of picture that we sometimes think, oh yeah, there's these super idealistic foundations that the nation was founded on. So discovering that, you know, it was a lot more complicated than that. I think initially it felt really discouraging. Mm. Sort of like, Are we doomed, you know, to sort of just be this, like, you know, any kind of movement towards democracy or equality or inclusion, you know, all of that kind of stuff. Is that all doomed?
Right.
But I think I appreciate that, hearing your summary of that book, I think, because it is, it reminds me that there, you know, that we're not doomed necessarily, that there has always been a struggle going on. And I, you know, from our perspective, this is not just a American thing or a political thing, but you know, it's a spiritual thing. It's a theological thing. It's a Christian thing.
Yeah.
I think for us, because yeah, there's always been this, I think it's a gospel, movement that seeks to include more people in the flourishing that, that God desires for us.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's, it feels inspiring to say, okay, we're not doomed necessarily, but there are these movements and we can participate.
Yeah. It's also helpful because, you know, we haven't used this phrase in several years, but we had a guest on that introduced me to the phrase of selective memory or like we have a selective memory as a country. Yeah. And one of the things I remember when I read history books, like readable popular history books, is that like some of the myths we tell ourselves are not only are not true, but they do unhelpful work. Like one of the myths I hear a lot is like, we've never been more divided as a country, or we used to be able to talk to each other. Public discourse is so toxic. And I read quotes like from like governors of Southern states calling for the lynching of black men or, you know, senators who are essentially wishing death upon their fellow senators throughout history. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, you know, the things that divided the country then are some of the same things that divide us now. Mm-hmm. And we actually have been in a worse place.
Right.
Like we actually have been more divided than we are now, you know? Yeah. And so not only is the myth not true, but it tends then to do bad work. And I'm kind of, it's never been harder for me to like know what's real and true and what isn't.
Yeah.
You know, I was watching a video online of, I think it was a video of Kamala Harris. And then I saw a picture of Kamala Harris. The Diddy news got released when we were recording this about P. Diddy having like kind of some R. Kelly allegations, but like on a bigger scale, just like really bad sexual assault, rape allegations. And there was a picture that had Kamala Harris with P. Diddy that, you know, Donald Trump tweeted out on Truth Social. And the implication was like, look who associated with this, you know, this miscreant. And it was like 12 hours later that it came out that it was AI altered, you know, like that picture was with Montel Williams, who was a talk show host from the 90s, not with P. Diddy. Mm-hmm. And then there's like a dozen pictures of Trump with P. Diddy.
Yeah.
And so like, I don't know, like the accumulation of that, where you see something and you're like, this looks real to me.
Right.
And then 12 hours later, you find out, no, that was digitally altered, or that was AI created, or that, you know, and the avalanche of like misinformation and reality distortion can leave one feeling like untethered from reality. And so one of the reasons I read history books is, and who quote like primary sources, is to be like, okay, this is real. Mm-hmm. This really happened. We know it happened because they said it happened. There's pictures of it happening. Yeah. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like just another example of this. My son brought his girlfriend to Chick-fil-A as our family ate out last weekend, Christian chicken. And there was somebody serving them that my son's girlfriend knew from school. And my wife was like, well, how do you know her? She's like, well, she got kicked out of my history class. And my wife was like, well, what happened? And they said, well, they were teaching on World War II. And that girl said that the Jews were to blame for the Holocaust.
Wow.
That it was their fault. And the teacher was like, no. And like, she doubled down on it. And then she got kicked out. And then later that young woman came up to my son's girlfriend, was like trying to recruit her to be like, not only was I right, but what the teacher did was wrong, like silencing my free speech. And, you know, this person's 16 or so. I don't know her at all. But I just trust that she legitimately believes that. Mm-hmm. I trust that she's not sort of trolling and lying. I trust that she's heard that from somewhere and that she believes it fully and that she fully believes that she's being persecuted. And I have so much sympathy for her because it's never been more difficult to discern between truth and a lie. Mm-hmm. I feel like it's never been more difficult to do that. So anyway, that's why I read history books. Sir, well, happy Monday morning, you two, when we're recording this. Hope you're feeling good now.
Yeah.
Always great to talk to your friend, Matt. He'll cheer you up right away. Any recommendations or stories you guys have?
Ben, have you been, reading comics or something? I don't know. Go to the other side.
Garfield. Gosh. Yeah. I saw this Garfield comic the other day. No, I had a birthday last week.
Happy birthday.
On Saturday. Yeah. Christy, I know you love birthdays.
I do. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I have a birthday. And the day this comes out.
Oh, no.
Tomorrow.
Is your birthday?
We're recording the day before, but.
Okay.
Yeah, my birthday is the
birthday
24th.
Coming up? Yep. I forgot, Christy, that we had birthdays so close to each other.
Yeah, birthday friends.
We are birthday friends.
Sorry, go ahead.
September's a great month for a birthday.
It is.
Well, I think you'd be proud of me, Christy, because normally I don't really make that big of a deal of my birthday.
But you celebrated?
But I did. This year, Vampire Weekend, one of my favorite bands, was coming to Indy on my birthday. They came on Saturday, September 21st. And so I just started liberally recruiting people to come to this show with me. I said, you know what? If you love me, you will come to my birthday party. It's a concert on the lawn. At this outdoor amphitheater here in Indianapolis. And it was great. We had loads of people. All my kids came. My son's girlfriend came. A bunch of friends. Matt was there. And a bunch of, a bunch of people were there. And it was loads of fun. We got there super early so that we could get a great spot on the lawn. And we did. We got a great spot on the lawn. We brought our food in with us. We did a little picnic on the lawn. We laid about.
Nice.
And talked with each other, and we enjoyed some music. And I think that to top it all off, the great experience for me was that we met somebody who we were sitting right by somebody whose birthday it also was. That she was there celebrating her birthday, and so we found these strangers, and we had this like commonality. And we kept kind of returning to that. It was a lot of fun. And then there's a part of the Vampire Weekend show where they will, they'll take requests and they try to play like non-Vampire Weekend songs. And they try to play songs that they've never played before. It's really actually kind of funny. And then somebody at the front shouted, "Hey, it's my birthday." So there's another person in the crowd with a birthday. And will you sing Happy Birthday? And they sang Happy Birthday. So I got Vampire Weekend singing, unbeknownst to them, singing Happy Birthday to me.
Mm-hmm. So fun.
And so I sang to, sang to my friend, my new friend, Happy Birthday. And she sang to me and we all sang Happy Birthday together. And then, I mean, this is kind of funny, but I actually found out that somebody I go to church with, it was his birthday yesterday as well. Mm-hmm. Not yesterday, but on Sunday we have the same birthday. And then I met somebody who, it was their first time visiting our church. I found somebody else who had the same birthday as me.
Good
so
grief.
All told, I know of four new people that share a birthday with me after this weekend. Mm. So anyway.
That's fun. Well, happy
we had loads of fun,
birthday.
Christy. I feel like you'd be proud of me.
I tried
to make a little bit of a more of a big deal about my birthday than I normally do.
That's mm-hmm. so good. And look at how celebrated you feel. So great.
I do. I feel great. I feel great. So
I love it.
I'll never doubt you again, Christy.
Oh, man.
How about you, Christy? You have anything real quick here? A recommendation or a story?
Yeah. I mean, I just came back from Guatemala. So I feel like I got a lot of Guatemalan stories. But I was there for a week. And a quick story is that I was with some people that are from a denomination that I knew did not align with ordaining women and would be in support of me being a pastor. And I found that out within like maybe 17 seconds of landing. And these people were going to be traveling with us. And so there was a little bit of nervousness of like, oh, I don't want to like disclose that I'm a pastor. but then obviously it comes out. I mean, you're traveling everywhere. And so I was just kind of quiet about it. And I was trying to figure out like, what's going on in me that like, I don't, I'm like so concerned about not offending this person or these people that I'm with. And and then we made a stop and we were with a whole bunch of women and our interpreter, I'm not great at Spanish, and our interpreter basically was like, I'd like you to share your story because these women would like to be pastors and in ministry. And I got to share with these women and there were tears and it kind of opened up these doors that then every place that we went, our interpreter was like, talk to this woman, talk to this group of women, talk to, you know, whatever. And just really beautiful of kind of the Lord just kind of opening up that door and saying, no, I want, like, you don't need to push the door and knock it over and like offend people. But when these moments are here, like, I think it deeply encouraged these women and kind of had some freedom of not caring so much about this other group of people. And so just thankful for those opportunities and that time.
I love that.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
So, that's me. But today, who are we talking to, Matt?
We're talking to Ben Sternke, and it was his birthday yesterday. I thought I introduced you.
I thought
all
that was the whole thing.
Sorry,
whole
episode. Yes.
No, we're talking to Chris Morris. Chris is a writer and an advocate for the mental health community, and he's passionate about redefining normal and building hope in the face of chronic illness and special needs. He's the author of 3 different books, and his articles have appeared in media outlets such as Fathom Magazine, Stigma, Fighters, Crosswalk, and The Mighty. You can learn more about him at chrismorriswrites.com. Today, we're chatting with him about his latest book, Resilient and Redeemed, Lessons About Suicidality and Depression from the Psych Ward. Chris Morris, welcome to the Gravity Commons podcast.
It's great to be here, guys. Thank you.
Yep. I read your bio, and you talk a bit about not only the context for the book we're going to chat about today, but also that you do a lot of writing. I wonder if that's what you do full time, or you have other ways of eking out a living in our late modern neoliberal capitalistic utopia we're living in?
Well, as you guys probably know, writing doesn't really pay the bills. So I do.
Except for like 3 people. I think 3 people make money writing in the world.
Yeah, I'm not Stephen King or John Grisham, so I do have a day job.
Or Max Lucado. I think he makes money. Anyway.
Yes.
That's it.
So I run a CPA firm for creative entrepreneurs, mostly in the author space, helping folks figure out their taxes. Not very exciting, but it does pay the bills.
Nice. How many hours a week does that take up for you?
Depends on the time of year. You know, during tax season, I'm working 50, 60 hours a week. Otherwise, it's 20 hours a week, maybe.
Yeah. I kind of wish I had had something like tax work I could fall back on. My wife does that. She's not a CPA, but she works for her brothers. But it's, you know, that whole saying about death and taxes. It's like, you'll never be out of a job.
Right.
Well, Chris, we're talking about Resilient and Redeemed today. And obviously, this is a very personal book for you as you tell the story and walk through how you experienced your own mental health struggles. Maybe this is an obvious question to ask a writer, but I'm wondering how you decided to share your story like this. What was the impetus or catalyst for you to put this all in a book?
Sure. So I think the big picture, the big reason I did it is because I started sharing little snippets on my blog and in other places, and I saw that people were resonating with primarily the ideas around the way that the church has poorly interacted with those who have mental health issues. Mm-hmm. So I realized there's really an audience and a place to sort of directly address some of those mental health challenges through the narrative of my life.
Yeah. What, you talk about this a bit in your book, Chris, and we've talked about this before in podcasts, and we've written about it on our website and stuff, but I wonder if you can share some of the ways in which your theology was insufficient or maybe even unhelpful for you kind of in the midst of that depression.
Sure. So I was sort of trained up with this idea that, gosh, how can I say it? Only the spiritually immature struggle with their mental health.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So there was a default of, well, I feel like I'm growing in Christ, but maybe it's not real because I'm struggling with my mental health. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until I really started paying attention to some of the characters in the Bible and the struggles they have. Right. I mean, Moses has a suicidal moment where he cries out to God, I'm done with these Israelites. Would you just kill me?
Yes.
Paul has a moment that seems really close to, he was at least deeply depressed, could have been suicidal. And then he leaned back into the goodness that's available on the cross of Christ. Mm-hmm. You know, just those two people, like that's sort of the big dogs of the Old Testament and the New Testament.
Right.
That helped me to understand, like, hey, if Moses and Paul didn't have it all together, either they were spiritually immature, which seems unlikely, or... Mm. Or perhaps, gasp, my theology might be incorrect.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I think there's it feels like a big paradigm shift, but it's one that's so important and necessary that somehow we have, somehow we've moralized these issues, right? Mental health. And I maybe you can understand looking back kind of how it happened or why we confused some of these mental health issues with spiritual immaturity, as you were saying, or even sin sometimes. But yeah, there is a really big and important, I think, paradigm shift happening for people to be able to see these things as, you know, medical issues, as injury issues, you know, the same way that you would look at, you know, a physical injury or, you know, cancer in your body or, you know, even just getting a scrape, you know, on your elbow, you know, that kind of a thing. So
yeah,
I think it's helpful.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up, Chris, for our listeners. I think there's this reticence, this sort of false pious propriety where we have to have this like performative virtue or this almost like this baseline sort of modicum of a good life if we're going to be a Christian, A, and B, if we're going to talk to God about it. And I'm glad you brought up, you know, characters in the Bible who are essentially pivotal, seminal, heroic characters, basically verbalizing that they want to commit suicide. Because I don't think we have that permission today to do the same kind of thing. I wonder if you could talk about that. It's been said that most churches don't talk about suicide or suicide ideation until someone attempts it or commits suicide. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that from your own experience, and what are some ways would have been helpful for you to hear it talked about, or what are some of the ways that you do talk about it?
Sure. So one of the churches I was in when I was younger, I can just sort of tell this story. I decided after my wife and I had a number of, we'll call them aggressive conversations, after we had a couple fights about my mental health and me needing to get some help, I scheduled an appointment with my pastor at the time. And sort of laid out for him, I'm struggling with my depression. I'm struggling with the beginnings of some suicidal ideations. And I really need some support. And his response to me was to lecture me on the fact that I was not doing all the things that good little Christians do. He didn't use that language, but I'll use it now. And he started the lecture by saying, you need to man up and pray more, which was deeply unhelpful.
Yeah.
And it sort of set me back a number of years because I was a young adult and I put my faith in my spiritual leader. And he was, I now recognize, misdirecting me. Mm. So I walked out of there like, dude, am I even saved?
Right.
I'm not even sure. You know, and I can contrast that with when I, my current pastor, when I was in the psych ward, one of the times I was in the psych ward, he came and visited me. And I was super nervous about him visiting me because I'd been gaslit by multiple Christian leaders.
Sure.
And I didn't want to have that happen again while I'm in the psych ward, because that's like, you're in a super dark place in that moment. Sure. You know, but you know, after a little bit of small talk, what he said to me is, Chris, we can't have this happen again. And he said it without judgment. He said it, you know, that the church, our church, isn't the full church if you're not in it doing the things that God's created you to do. And then he said, and God's not done writing your story yet. And I tell that little snippet from my life because I think those are two important things that can be communicated broadly to mental illness communities. Mm-hmm. Hey, you, number one, there's value, not in a transactional way, but in a community-oriented, organic way.
Yeah,
there's value that you bring to our community that no one else is capable of bringing. And to the degree that you're pulling back from community out of fear of judgment or fear of not measuring up, we're the ones that are missing out. You're missing out too, but we're all missing out because you're not there. And then that concept of God isn't done writing your story yet. You know, that there can be a sense of toxic positivity that can come with language like that. It could be like, it's going to get better, dude. Yeah. And sometimes it doesn't get better for a really long time.
Yeah.
And sometimes it never gets better. But this idea of God is still in your midst. He is still doing something. Mm-hmm. I don't understand what that something is because he's God and I'm not, and he's smarter than I am. And he's got this massive cosmic fabric that he's weaving together. But I know that you're not forgotten. I know that you're loved. Communicating those things to folks who are struggling and doing it in consistent, meaningful, public ways. So a lot of times you'll see pastors from the pulpit, they might mention, hey, and if you're struggling with fill in the blank, you know, there's certain sins or certain struggles, because I don't want to categorize mental illness as a sin, but there's certain things. Hey, if you're struggling with fill in the blank, just know that this is how what we're talking about today applies to you. Yeah. I think that pastors can normalize talking about mental health by saying, hey, if you're struggling with worry right now, here's some tips for you. Here's some things to remember. Here's how what we're talking about today makes sense of the worry that you're having in your life.
Yeah. We'll be right back.
Respero. Hey, we've talked about them before. They're an organization that offers faith-based counselor training. They believe that the aim of counseling is real transformation, not just symptom management or removal. Their counselor training courses equip you to help people to be great lovers of others, to understand why they do what they do, to be emotionally healthy, and to live out their identity as someone deeply loved and delighted in by God. All their training is rooted in the belief that Jesus is a source of life and that we can be a part of his work of healing and restoration.
And for pastors and ministry leaders, their training is a proven way to identify the people in your church who might be gifted for lay counseling. And it can be a powerful way to help make your church into a genuine healing community. They provide all the training and the supervision that allows your leaders to do great work and to free up pastoral staff from needing to do all the pastoral counseling in your church. If you are interested, you can go to respero.org. That's R-E-S-P-E-R-O www.thecounselortraining.org and click on the Counselor Training tab.
The Gravity Podcast is sponsored by the Gravity Formation Course, a 12-month cohort-based training in practical spiritual formation, where you'll learn to notice how God is already at work in your life so you can participate more fully in the life God shares with us. It's a discipleship process that goes beyond just gaining more knowledge and trying new practices. In the Gravity Formation Course, we go below the surface of our lives so that we can notice and name our deepest desires in God's presence, and to discern how God is at work in those desires to lead us towards holistic flourishing, more transformation, more life, more joy, more love. We've trained hundreds of people all over the world in this formation framework, and it has helped many people to have a sense of God at work in their lives, to learn how to be more at home in God's love. If you'd like to learn more, go to gravitycommons.com/formation.
Let's get back to the show.
Yeah, Chris, I'm struck by, the difference between those two approaches, the two pastors that you mentioned. The first pastor seeking to, seeking to leverage shame to get you to behave differently.
Yes.
And the second, proclaiming good news to you about your identity and inviting you to change. You know what I mean? Like, that, make no mistake, he didn't say, no big deal, do whatever you want. You know, he was like, this can't happen again, right? But inviting you to change based on this proclamation of your worth and the goodness of who you are and your place in the community. And just how different that is. That's the first observation, I guess, that I just wanted to highlight or point out. And I think my question is related to that. You said it set you back a few years when the first pastor, shamed you. But at the time, it doesn't sound like you knew what was going on at the time. It wasn't like you walked out of the office and said, "Well, that guy didn't give me very good advice. I'm not going to follow that." It sounds like
No, not at all.
Yeah, so you walked out taking it seriously, and that's actually what caused the harm for you. I wonder if you can just. I guess what I'm wondering is, looking back now, you can kind of see what was going on for what it was. But in the moment, you again, like you said, you're a young person. This is your spiritual leader, probably a mentor figure to you. And so you want to take what they're saying seriously. What was the process like for you of kind of coming to the realization that that wasn't helpful? And I don't know, like what did you go through to try to sort of reorient yourself to a new way of looking at what that was and why it wasn't helpful? I don't know if that question makes sense. Yeah.
It does make sense. And that's a great question, Ben. Thank you for asking that. There were a couple stages. The first piece for me had to do with taking medication for my depression and suicidality.
Okay.
Because another part of the story that was told to me was that if you're taking psychotherapeutic medication, that you lack faith.
Right.
Because God is the one who can heal you. And so for a good, 7-8 years, I was dealing with untreated depression. And I was kind of a terrible human being. I'll just say it that way. I was not my best self. You know, my kids and my wife can attest to that. So sort of out of, well, if this sets me back as in my faith or not, whatever, something has to change.
Yeah.
So I started taking just a basic antidepressant and started noticing some shifts. And then I stayed in that place of taking antidepressants and feeling bad about it for a very long time. And then the same pastor who visited me in the psych ward said something from the pulpit that really gave me permission to be more transparent with my community and to seek additional help. And he was doing this series called Confessions of a Longtime Pastor or something like that. Okay. And he started his sermon by saying, "Hey guys, I'm Marty. I'm one of the leaders here," which is what they always say. Mm-hmm. "And I take antidepressants, and I'm a better person because of it." And he went on and he talked a whole sermon about the value of seeking whatever help you need to take care of yourself when it comes to your mental health. And I really took that to heart. This was, you know, probably about a decade ago now. So I started looking for a counselor, and that's the first thing that I did, which had mixed results. Okay. I eventually landed on a good counselor, but there's some almost comical stories in the meantime.
Yeah. So that was the part of the book that struck me, Chris, I wanted to ask you about, because I just had to break up with a counselor. And I decided,
it's me. Did you use that line?
I thought through all the options, like just cancel and ghost him.
Yeah.
Or make up a excuse. And it's hard. I feel like it's really hard to find a good therapist, and it's really hard to break up with a bad therapist for me. And so I ended up just telling him the truth. Not "you're bad, but I'm taking a step back and reconsidering therapy right now. I'll let you know when I'm ready to reengage with you." And I felt like that was a way of politely being very clear that I'm kind of done here until I tell you otherwise, but also not, you know, going scorched earth on a guy doing the best he can. But I wonder if you could tell us, Chris, like some of the things that were unhelpful for you with counselors. What were some of the things that you would, if other people are experiencing that, you would maybe validate their concerns? Mm. And then what are some of the things that the therapists that you've appreciated the most, what are some of the things that they've been able to be for you or do for you that you would commend to others?
Okay, yeah. So I have a chapter called "My Weird Therapist" in the book, or "My Two Weird Therapists" or something like that. Let me sort of start with the end in mind, and then I'll talk about some of the things that were unhelpful. So what I learned from engaging these two poor therapists was that I need to approach a first appointment with a therapist the way you'd approach a first date, and really, come at it like, first of all, not come at it like, "And why are you here today?" Well, and just vomit all on them, because that's not a helpful response. And then sort of be thinking about like, "Hey, is this going to be a relationship that's going to make sense for me, that's going to work for me?" Because it is a uniquely intimate relationship that you're trying to develop with a stranger. So we have to figure out what are the go, no-go signs, if you will. And I learned to ask a few really direct questions.
Ooh, let's hear. I'm going to write these down.
Well, pen. One of them is super specific for me. I have a seizure disorder. And what my seizure disorder looks like is they're called absence seizures. So I just freeze in time for 10 to 60 seconds usually.
Wow.
So I communicate, "Hey, I have a seizure disorder. There's a good possibility, since we're going to meeting regularly, that this might happen when we're in a meeting. Are you okay with that? Are you going to be okay with that? There's nothing you need to do. I'll be fine. Are you going to freak out?" Because, by the way, I had that was my first bad counselor. I had a seizure in the middle of one of my sessions. And when I came to, her eyes were wide as saucers, and she was like kind of slowly backing away from me. And I was like, "Ooh, did I just have a seizure?" She goes, "I don't know what just happened, but that freaked me the out."
Yeah.
Oh gosh, wow.
Yeah, totally.
So then I had her go get my wife, and my wife and I counseled my counselor for the rest of my session. And then obviously I was like, "Hey, this isn't going to work." I just bailed on her. I just ghosted her.
Yeah. Great.
And then the second question that I ask is not necessarily, "Are you a Christian counselor?" because sometimes Christian counselor comes with weird baggage, especially if they say mm-hmm. they're a biblical counselor.
Yeah.
That sort of means I don't want to work with them and I don't want to take the time to try and discern. But I say something like, faith is a really important component of my life, and it's something that I'm going to struggle through as I'm working through my mental health. Yeah. Is that something that you're going to be open to encouraging? I'm not looking for you to pastor me. I'm not looking for you to shepherd me. I just need you not to be negative toward my faith.
Right.
Because then we have a problem. And that sort of dials into my second bad counselor or weird counselor. I was just expressing to her something like, I had a comment like, things are really hard and I'm not sure where God fits into this. That was all that I said. And that was like the opening salvo of our counseling session. And she took the next 40 minutes to rail on how Christianity is a crutch.
Oh, gosh.
And how people who are really informed on how to live their life would never lean on a weak, non-existent God to base their life on. And I'm like, whoa. Yeah. So I actually wrote her a letter. I didn't just ghost her. I wrote her a letter expressing some of my frustrations. She probably didn't even read it, but I felt better sort of laying it out there.
Sure. Yeah.
So those are and I think the questions that we want to ask our counselor, those go, no go questions, are going to be different for each of us. But really thinking about what are those things that are going to make me feel comfortable enough to be transparent and honest and intimate enough for the counseling to be worthwhile. I think those are really important things to consider.
Yeah.
And then that sort of brings me to my really profound, really positive counseling experience. This guy, ironically, he has like the weirdest background religiously that I've ever come across. He was a former Catholic priest who renounced his priesthood, is seriously studying Buddhism, and has a lot of positivity toward New Age thoughts. But despite all that, he was very open to me wrestling with my faith.
Yeah.
And the thing that he communicated to me were things like, Chris, no matter what you're going through, I want you to know that I've probably dealt with it before, not to minimize the pain and the uniqueness of your situation. But I've been counseling for a long time. And I'm familiar with most of the things that are going to sort of come into my ears. And I'm convinced that, you know, that the depth of what you're feeling is not going to last forever. I'm not saying it's going to go away, but there's seasons to these things. So if you can hang on, even in those seasons, then it's going to be really helpful for you to do that. And he really helped me. One of my big problems, it's called catastrophizing. Oh, it's a fancy word for making mountains out of molehills. He was really helpful at pointing out to me, no, that's a molehill, Chris. Let's cognitively reframe this so that you can see it with the proper perspective. Rather than making it feel like the end of the world, it's actually a speed bump. Those were the things that he was helpful for me with. Because catastrophizing is a huge problem for me, even now.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that metaphor of treating it like a date. of course, I haven't been on a date since last century. And so it's kind of hard to think through, like, how would I... You know, this isn't about me, but like a lot of my issue is I have a hard time trusting people in authority over me. And so I'm already like wrestling with, can I trust this person? Are they competent, et cetera? And that's one of the reasons I broke up with my therapist is because they did a couple things that indicated to me they weren't competent. And then I checked it out with another therapist, and she was like, yeah, you need to get out of there. So that just like actually reinforces some of my issues. Anyway, again, this isn't about me. See, I'm right. I'm right. Crap.
I'm right to catastrophize.
But I do like the fact that I think there's agency in advocating for ourselves, Chris, yeah. that you're describing, like taking yes. seriously that our health and healing and wholeness is something we can champion for ourselves mm-hmm. and take some responsibility and dominion in. We don't have to be helpless or secluded. We don't have to either be, we don't have to come and just abandon all agency with a therapist or seclude it and be all on our own and work on ourselves. But you're narrating kind of this sort of this place of interdependency where you maintain some agency and advocacy. And I think that I need to hear that today. And I know that others probably do too.
So. Yeah. It was a long process for me to kind of get to that point and realize that I like the way you describe that. I maintain my agency in these relationships. And I sort of have responsibility to maintain that if I want to be honest with myself and be my most helpful self to myself.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really helpful. I wonder if we can maybe pivot and just talk briefly about medicine, pharmacology. You mentioned it, you know, before. It was actually part of, like you said, like things had gotten so bad for you that you know, like even if it means I'm spiritually immature, maybe not even saved, I got to take the meds and see if this helps, you know. Which is, that reminds me actually of another thing I wanted to ask you about, but I'll put a pin in it. But I'll put a pin in it with the two of you, so maybe y'all can remind me just in case I forget. But you know, this is the pin. Part of what we want to do is separate the idea of our mental health from like overt sin. So it's like, it's not like I'm struggling with my mental health, and that means that I am sinful. But you did make a connection between I have this untreated mental illness, and because of that, I'm a terrible person. You know what I mean? Like I am actually sinning, perhaps, and mistreating people out of this illness that I have. But it's not that the illness means that I'm sinful. Does that make sense? I don't know, maybe we can just start there. Maybe let's start. That pin was so large that now it's become maybe a question that I want to ask. I wonder if you can tell us about that a little bit, because I think that's an interesting nuance that I think is important for people to hear, but maybe one that's difficult to tease apart, where people still may feel like, oh, my mental illness is a sin or is sinful in and of itself. I don't know if you can talk a bit about that.
Sure. I think the construct I want to use is out of Ephesians 4, where it says, in your anger, do not sin. Mm-hmm. So this is going to be a weird place, but I'm going to pivot off of that idea.
Okay.
So, and the reason I want to use that is because so many people in Christian circles automatically assume if you're feeling or even beginning to express anger, that it is sin.
Right.
But Paul writes, in your anger, do not sin. He's not going to write something that's nonsensical. So there's a distinction between the anger and the expression of that anger in a sinful way.
Right.
Yeah. And I think that's a useful paradigm for my experience. I felt, you know, when I'm thinking about my experiences during those 7-8 years that I was untreated for my depression, while I was experiencing that, I was definitely thinking, I'm such a crappy person. And it's because of my mental health. But looking back on it, I can definitely see a distinction where it's sort of that in your anger, do not sin a deal, where my untreated mental illness, my untreated depression caused me to react to people in ways that was that were unhealthy and that were indeed sinful. Mm-hmm. But it was not, I am a depressed, sinful person.
Right.
It was, I am someone struggling with depression who is expressing that struggle in sinful ways.
Yes.
I hope that's a helpful way to break it out.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's really helpful.
Because you're right. Paul didn't say, in your sin, do not sin, right? He's right. Making a distinction between those things. And I think it is helpful because, you know, it's helpful for us to realize that, like, nobody chooses to have a mental illness, right? Nobody chooses to have these kinds of issues going on for us, right? But when we discover that we have something, and this, you know, this goes for anything, right? It might be an anger problem, like, you know, to use your analogy. When we discover that that's present within us, mm-hmm. then it does become our responsibility to deal with it in a healthy way, right? And that's part of what you're advocating for here is to say, like, dealing with it in a healthy way is not heaping shame on yourself for being such a dirty, rotten scoundrel, but it does mean, oh, I have this thing about me that can cause me to perceive people in a way that makes me mistreat them. And because of that, I need to take responsibility for that thing about me so that I don't mistreat people. And so I do what I can, and I, you know, maybe I take medicine, you know, all of that kind of thing. Hmm. Which maybe leads me to my next question about pharmacology. I think there is a stigma about medicine that you've mentioned, you know, about taking medicine that's sort of maybe second best, or, you know, if we really trusted God to heal us, that we wouldn't need medicine, that kind of a thing. I wonder what you would say to people who may be struggling with that thought, that kind of thinking.
Yeah, it's sort of, it ties into this, another really common myth that you hear in Christian circles, and it is that mental health is only a spiritual problem. And really, unless you address that head on, then you're never going to end up in a place where you're going to be comfortable with taking psychotherapeutic meds to deal with your mental health struggles. And the true reality is not that mental health is a spiritual problem. And the reason that's not true is because we are holistic human beings. God didn't create the emotions on one day and then the soul on another day and then decided to add a body at the last second.
Right.
Now, you created us all in the same moment. You know, however you read the creation narrative, it happened sort of simultaneously. So we're holistic human beings. I can prove this to you with a really funny word, hangry. We've all been hangry.
Right.
Yes.
Where we're not our best selves because we're hungry. But that is actually evidence of a deeper truth where our emotional life is influenced by our physical life, is influenced by our community life. Everything is connected. Mm. So that means a couple things. The first thing that means is a lot of times the reason we're struggling with our mental health is because something is awry physically in our body, in our physical brain, that needs to be adjusted. And in that sense, it's actually really similar to someone who takes insulin shots. Hey, we're just fixing something that's not working properly in your body.
Right. Yeah.
And then the other correlation is this: there are other things that are not pharmaceutically related that also influence our mental health. If you have really terrible sleep hygiene, you're getting 3.5 to 4 hours of sleep every single night. Hey, you're probably not going to be your best self.
Right.
If you're skipping breakfast and lunch and eating 5,000 calories for dinner, there's a good chance that that's influencing your mental health. I'm using really easy examples to make the point that we are holistic human beings. And once we can sort of satisfy that understanding in our brains that everything is connected, then the stigma around taking medication to manage our mental health feels a lot less, it feels a lot weaker, and it's much more easy to jump over that and to move forward toward mental health.
And now a word from a sponsor. All right, let's get back into our conversation.
Yeah, well, maybe, Chris, I know we haven't really talked about what led you to the psych ward. And, you know, listeners can read the book and hear about that. But I actually have a lot of friends. By a lot, I mean more than I would think.
without having talked to them, who are clinically depressed. And many of them have tried to pray the depression away, and it hasn't worked. I wonder, as someone who has dealt with depression, and to the degree you still are dealing with depression, what sort of advice or what would you share with somebody who said, hey, I'm depressed, what should I do?
Yeah, I think that's a really great question. That for, and I can speak mostly out of how depression sort of shows up in my life. How it shows up in my life is not one or not two negative thoughts, but like 15 negative thoughts sort of coming at me all at the same time. Mm. So I'm at the bottom of a dog pile and I feel helpless to do anything. And the way that I've learned to deal with that is sort of a reflection on the idea of taking your thoughts captive in Christ. And what that looks like for me super practically is I tell these thoughts, okay, I'm going to deal with you one at a time. So line up. And then I'm going to sort of cognitively reframe each thought as it comes at me. So maybe the first thought is, you're a terrible father. Look at how your kids are living their lives. Look at what they're doing as young adults. You're a terrible father. Mm-hmm. So I might reframe that by saying, well, first of all, my kids are actually doing fairly well. Second of all, they're free moral agents because they're adults and they're outside of my control. You know, I've done my best to guide them. And third, I actually have good relationships with all of them, which indicates that something has gone well. So maybe I'm at least a half decent dad. I may not be number one dad, but I'm at least half decent, which means I'm not horrible.
Right.
All right. Next thought. Yeah. And it took me a lot of years to sort of learn how to do that. And it feels super unnatural. Yeah. But we have to remember that in the same way that we have the agency to be engaged with our counselor, when we're dealing with our own thoughts, we're not a victim of the thoughts that come into our mind. Right. We can manage them and we can engage them in the way that we want to engage them. So that's the first thing I would say. And the second thing I would say is that the fact that you're talking, if someone were to come to me and say, hey, I'm really struggling with this, what do I do? I would say the fact that you're talking to me about it is a really positive step, because one thing that depression hates is community.
Yeah.
So if there are other people like me that you feel are safe, that you can engage with in a non-therapeutic but just realistic friendship level, like, hey, I'm having a really hard time here. I think that's going to be really valuable.
Yeah. Yeah, that corresponds a bit too about kind of what that pastor had to say to you in the psych ward, right? Where he said, we aren't the same without you. We want you. You're important to us. You belong to us, right? Yeah. And I think that's the first thing. I think you're trying to do with and for yourself what that pastor did for you. There's also this skill or competency or capacity of sort of being your own resonating witness, being your own, like inhabiting your true self to talk to the broken pieces and parts about what's real. And I feel like for many of us, that's really hard to do, Chris, you know, because those broken bits and pieces feel like the real, the true, the only self I have. Do you remember how you came to develop that capacity? Like at some point, I'm assuming you didn't do that and now you do. How did you learn to do that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. You're right. It was a struggle for a lot of years. I have, like most people, I have a fair bit of trauma in my background. Mm-hmm. I say most people. I think everyone who has trauma says most people have trauma. I don't even know if that's true. But I like to pretend that it is, so I feel a little more normal. But I have a fair bit of trauma in my background, and it really influenced the way that I viewed myself. And the first thing that I did when I sort of, I like realized, hey, all of this negative stuff that I believe about myself doesn't seem to line up with what other people believe about me. I wonder why that is. And I wonder, rather than having to sort of ascertain through, you know, assumptions what other people think about me, let me grab some real concrete things that people who I know are for me, what they think about me. So I ask some close friends a couple questions. Questions like, when you think of Chris, what are the adjectives that you think of? What are some things that Chris is really good at? When you're struggling with X, you go to Chris. What is X? So I sort of was loading myself up with ammunition of what other people believed was true about me. And so that when those broken pieces began to resonate really strongly within myself, I could say, you know what, though? Lindsay really believes this about me. And my wife, Barbara, really believes this about me. And Kevin said, I'm really good at this. Maybe, just maybe, this broken piece that I've always accepted as true actually isn't true. And I had to start it that way with that doubt of maybe it's not true, because it was too hard. It was too big of a step for me to say,
yes,
to cognitively reframe it immediately. This is definitively not true.
Yes, that's so important, Chris. I want to highlight this for listeners. Like, the sometimes you have to introduce doubt and a little bit of space between unhelpful mental frames and yourself. So, what you did was, maybe other people can see me more clearly than I can, or what if other people can see what's true about me better than me? Right? And just that possibility led you to be curious. And then it introduced a kind of a, if I can use a metaphor, a virus of doubt. Right? That then the depression app could start glitching a little bit with. And once again, too, it is a move towards people, towards community, right? You know, and they're saying things that affirm your belonging and your significance to them, you know, rather than, well, your eating habits are a little subpar, Chris. You really, you know, like it wasn't like that kind of thing. So, yeah, I'm just noticing how like community and then creating some kind of, I call it distance or space. So rather than Chris being depressed, Chris could identify depressive thoughts.
Yes. Right.
And the difference between those two things is like being in a psych ward and being on a podcast, probably.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Man.
It's really good.
Yeah. It's great.
I appreciate the way, Chris, that you... I don't know, like it feels like we've talked about a lot of really profoundly helpful things, but they're very, very simple and you make them very, very simple. And so I appreciate that. It feels like we just laid out several just really helpful things, and your book is full of that kind of stuff. So I'm grateful for you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, Chris.
Thank you for that.
I'm grateful too for, I think there's, you know, you and I know each other from social media, and I choose to talk about things that I think I know that I'm violating or transgressing something by talking about them. Like there's certain social or cultural mores or norms that dictate what we talk about and what we don't. Right. And I think part of why your book is so helpful is because it is transgressive in a way. We're not supposed to talk about suicidality and depression and talking about how we got in a psych ward. As a Christian, we're just not supposed to talk about that. But I think because you chose to have courage and share this story with us and this book with us, it gives us permission and brings healing and wholeness. So thank you, man. I know it's not the only thing you've written. And so would you take this opportunity to plug where people can find other things that you've written?
Sure. I'm happy to do that. You can go to my website, chrismorriswrites.com. There's a, I think it's like /books, but you can just click along books at the top and you'll see I recently wrote a devotional called By Faith that walks through Hebrews chapter 11, the hall of faith, sort of with eyes toward long suffering, because most of the folks that are listed in the hall of faith either only got part of what they were promised or got none of what they promised. And I feel like that really connects with the journey that we have with God nowadays, because most of us are waiting for the fullness of something to reflect in our lives. And then I have a book that's coming out in September called Trekking Toward Tenacity. That's kind of a parenting book. We walk through Psalm 139 with an eye toward answering this question. What can we do as parents super practically to help our kids develop bounce back ability in their faith and with their mental health? So those are the two books I'd want to highlight.
Yeah, man. That's great. That's great. Well, Chris, the book we're talking about today, Resilient and Redeemed, Lessons About Suicidality and Depression from the Psych Ward. Thanks so much for the book and for being with us today.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So a few things that I think I needed to hear from Chris. The first is, you know, I'm learning to identify the way that ADHD and PTSD impact me and the ways that I moralize those things rather than dealt with them as like a biological or neurological condition that needs sort of like the full canopy of human ingenuity to deal with. And so I think, listener, this may not be you, but you may come from a Christian tradition where whatever antipathy or pathology seizes you, it was spiritualized only. And I just want to proclaim release to the captives there. Chris did. And I want to affirm and amen his release that we don't need to spiritualize these things that seize our bodies.
Right. Yeah. I mean, spiritualize in the way that, you know, the way that you're talking about it, where it's like, this is a moral, or a spiritual problem only, and that I don't treat it like I would treat, you know, a tumor that, you know, needs to, I need to have surgery for this, or, you know, I have an inflamed appendix, you know, we don't, we don't automatically jump in those situations to where I must have sinned for somehow, you know, because I've got this inflamed appendix, you know, or I'm a spiritually immature Christian because I have this inflamed appendix.
Right.
Yeah. We just don't jump to those things.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, that's the first thing. And then the second thing is, I think, you know, describing his process from going from somebody whose depression led them into the psych ward to learning how to move towards people and let other people's voices set up sort of a, to sabotage his depression.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So I think that's great. And I think I can anticipate some listeners with depression thinking, I've tried that and it hasn't worked.
Right.
Or, I'm so glad that worked for him, but I don't know how to do that. And I just want to say, I anticipate people, it not being as, I know this wasn't easy. Anytime you end up in a psych ward, it's not easy.
Right.
But, you know, some of us, you know, try to get pregnant for years and it, it finally works and some of us don't. And some of us receive affirmation and validation from others, and eventually that mind worm works its way into the to the programming and it begins to scramble it a bit. And then sometimes for others of us, it doesn't. And sometimes some of us take this medication or that medication and it works. And then for some of us, it doesn't. And so I just want to acknowledge there's a wide variety of experiences here.
Yeah.
And to the degree that Chris's story can be encouraging and beneficial and hopeful, great. But I think everybody's story is different.
Yeah. Yeah. It's we have to resist the temptation to moralize, you know what I mean? Like we to moralize even what Chris has done, you know, and sort of make that like, oh, well, he's that worked for him because he did it right or he tried really hard or, you know, whatever. But yeah, I think that's that. I mean, one of the gifts I think of living nowadays is we just have so many, you know, you mentioned the full, the full arsenal of human ingenuity to deal with some of these issues. And we just have so much more today than we used to have, even like 20 years ago.
Yep.
In terms of dealing with trauma, our understanding of how that gets embedded in our bodies and all of this. And so there's, you know, and there's like all kinds of different therapeutic models. There's all kinds of different drugs. Like there's a lot that we have today that, that I think we should look at that as just like, well, that worked for him and that's wonderful. And so even if you've tried what worked exactly for him and it doesn't work for you, again, resisting the temptation to moralize that and say, well, I guess I suck as a person then. Yeah. It's like, no, that's just, you know, maybe something else will work. And we just sort of fight these things as we try to work through these things as we are able to. And it can be really hard, but it can be made easier, I think, when we refuse to moralize these situations and just say, I'm working on it.
Yep.
So
that's good.
Yeah.
Ben, did I tell you about the man that walked into the bar?
I think you have. That's all the time we have today, listener.
This is a different one. This guy's Herbert.
Okay. Oh, okay.
I don't think I've told you about Herbert.
I don't think I've heard this guy's story.
So Herbert walks into a bar. And the bartender says, I'm sorry, sir, you can't bring your dog in here. And Herbert says, this is my seeing eye dog. And the bartender says, your seeing eye dog's a chihuahua? And Herbert says, my seeing eye dog's a chihuahua.
Pretty good.
Hey. Hey. What do you think?
No idea. Yeah, I get it. I get it. And you got a chuckle from me, so.
I told you. You know, I hadn't told you about Herbert yet.
You're welcome. You're welcome for the chuckle.
All right, everybody.
Serving my friends as Christ loves the church. So, see you all next time. Peace.
Peace.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Podcast. If you're finding it helpful, please tell your friends about it. Word of mouth is the best advertising. Ratings and reviews online also help others find the podcast. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. To join discussions about the podcast and lots more, join us in the Gravity Commons. It's free to join, and you can connect with other listeners to the podcast to talk about faith, spirituality, and whatever else comes up. To join, go to gravitycommons.com/community. The Gravity Podcast is produced by Ben Sturkey and Matt Tebby. Aaron Sturkey edits and mixes the podcast. You can check out his mixing, engineering, and production work at aaronsturkey.com. We'd love to hear from you. To record a question or a comment for us, go to gravitycommons.com/message and click Start Recording button. You can also email us at podcast@gravitycommons.com. Catch you next time.
Zaxby's Sensation Salad is so much more than a plain old salad. It's a salad, which begs the question, at what point does a salad stop being a salad and become a salad? Is it when you add Zaxby's fried chicken to it? Crunchy wontons? Asian slaw? Citrus vinaigrette? Teriyaki glaze? Sweet and spicy sauce? Or is it when you top it all with a handmade perfectly fried egg roll? Without a doubt, the egg roll. The Sensation Salad, only at Zaxby's.